From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party swept to power in 2014, promising to cut corruption, reform and fire up India's economy, and modernize the country. The Modi government has also seen a closer relationship between the United States and India as President Obama pivots toward Asia and hopes that India, the world's largest democracy, might balance a rising China. Tomorrow, Prime Minister Modi addresses a joint session of Congress. This hour on Point, India and the United States. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How far can this relationship go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was President Obama in India in January last year, speaking to a crowd in New Delhi.
India and the United States are not just natural partners. I believe America can be India's best partner. I believe that. Of course, only Indians can decide India's role in the world.
And Prime Minister Modi, after winning the 2014 election, he addressed a group of excited supporters talking about facing the world with pride, hopes and dreams coming true.
This election has laid the foundations of modern India. Brothers and sisters, your hopes and your dreams will come true. You will be able to look into the face of the world with pride.
Joining me first today from Washington is Alyssa Ayers, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. She was Project Director there for their Independent Task Force on U.S.-India Relations. She served in the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia. She's currently writing a book on India. Alyssa Ayers, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on and for taking the time to focus on India, which doesn't get the attention it deserves.
Very happy to do it. Spent a very happy year there earlier in life. But what specifically is on the agenda? We'll look at the big dynamics between these two countries, but what's on the agenda for this Modi visit in Washington?
So today, Prime Minister Modi arrived yesterday evening, and the first stop he made was to visit Arlington National Cemetery and paid his tributes to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and also to the victims of the Space Shuttle Challenger. There was an Indian-American scientist who was on that flight
right.
and perished. So that was an interesting stop. I don't believe there had been a visit by an Indian prime minister to Arlington in several decades. The next thing he did was have a meeting with our Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, who gave back some important Indian antiquities that had been smuggled out of India and ended up on the market in the United States. So giving those ancient antiquities back to India was another important stop. Then he had a dinner with think tank heads talking about strategic issues. I was not part of that, so I'm not sure what happened in their discussion, but that sort of comprised his first day.
Let's look I want to look at climate change, security relations, economic relations. What's he hoping for? What's the U.S. hoping for?
Well, that's going to be, I think, the subject of today's program, where he'll have his executive branch meetings. He's going to be meeting with, of course, President Obama. They'll have a larger meeting, a smaller meeting. And I think if you look at the agenda items that are most likely to be discussed, defense is going to be a big piece. When U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter recently visited India, during the course of his visit, both countries flagged that they'd reached a conclusion on a possible logistics exchange agreement. So we're hopeful that that will be announced today.
What does that mean, Alyssa, a logistics exchange, that we can use each other's bases is what I'm reading here, something like that?
Yeah, something like that on a case-by-case basis, you know, to facilitate if an Indian vessel is passing through somewhere and would like to stop and refuel.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be renegotiated, the terms of that use and the repayment and this sort of thing. It just facilitates making that easier.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that has been under discussion for probably close to a decade now. And coming to terms on that agreement would actually make it easier for both countries to work together on sort of defense types of issues, patrols and things. Actually, I should note that right now there's a major defense exercise going on right now, the United States, India, and Japan, the Malabar exercise, which has been underway for many years, but with all three countries participating, is just another indication of how close the defense relationship is growing.
Are we talking about these countries becoming military allies, or is it something more arm's length than that?
India is not interested in an alliance with the United States or with any other country. Mm-hmm. And that's something you were kind enough to flag the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force report we did. And one of our comments in that, what, you know, part of the challenge in figuring out how the United States can work with India is figuring out a way to work with a rising power that isn't interested in an alliance relationship with the United States.
Because of its history of colonialism, it doesn't want to be tied to a superpower?
Well, kind of. There's two aspects of that. So one aspect is India is not interested in being a junior partner to anybody. Mm-hmm. And the United States is the world's superpower. And they're not interested in having any kind of relationship that could be less than equals. But on top of that, they do have this long history of being a great proponent of non-alignment. They were a founder of the non-aligned movement. And the non-alignment principles really focused on ensuring that they walked a middle path of not being part of any alliance in either the West or the East. So you see a lot of vestiges of that.
Alliance in formal, old-fashioned American terms, maybe not on the table. You talk about a new joint venture format that might work instead. Mm-hmm. We'll look at that. Climate change. Mm-hmm. Will India agree to the Paris Climate Agreement during this visit by Modi to Washington?
Well, I am not sure. Mm-hmm. India has been, it was interesting in Paris. We saw an India step forward and with a very positive agenda. In Paris, India still did not agree to a date certain at which it would cap its carbon emissions. But it did talk about reducing its carbon energy intensity. And most importantly, it focused on its announcement of the rapid deployment of renewable energies. So you see an India that still has great concerns about being treated fairly in the international system. Its per capita emissions are much lower than every other country, every other major country. And India is still looking to find the solution. And so it sees its leadership on this question of clean energy, renewable energy. That has been a particularly fruitful area of partnership between the U.S. and India. There's been a partnership to advance clean energy, which is known as PACE, the acronym. More than $2 billion have gone into funding that. Scientists working together from both countries to develop new solar energy technologies, biofuel technologies, green buildings.
Of course, so per capita emissions so low in India, in no small part because so many still live in abject poverty in India,
don't even have
access to power. And the worry that if and when they do, you could see an explosion in carbon emissions if they don't get on the Copenhagen train. Some of our listeners may have heard news developments on that by the time they hear this show. That's on the table today. What about the economy? We remember not so long ago, a decade and more, an American ambassador saying that U.S.-India trade was flat as a chapati.
Right.
And we heard Bob Corker saying just last month that there was a widening expectations gap emerging between the U.S. and India on promised economic reforms that haven't really emerged, even under Narendra Modi.
Yeah, I've got mixed views on this. So let me say this. U.S.-India trade has expanded dramatically compared to the past. It was once flat as a chapati, as Ambassador mm-hmm. Blackwell said. In 2015, U.S.-India trade in goods and services crossed $100 billion. So that's good. That's mm-hmm. a positive development. It's, grown five times or something in the last 15 years. It's still only the size of trade between the United States and Taiwan or the Netherlands. It's about one-sixth the trade between U.S.-China in goods. So you can see where the potential actually exists. There's been progress, but it doesn't meet where it could go yet. And so there's a lot of work that remains. On the question of reforms, Modi has done and his government has done quite a bit on reforms. They've done quite a bit on cleaning up government. There's been no corruption scandals in the last 2 years. They've managed to pass some reforms that didn't make it through the entire decade of the previous government, including on important sectors like insurance. The challenge is that I think people expected him to do much more and much faster. So I think people look at what hasn't happened, some particularly contentious reforms like labor reform, like land acquisition reform, knitting together the country in a unified goods and services tax. That would require a constitutional amendment, and it just hasn't yet happened in 2 years. So I think people look at that and say, well, we thought he would do so much more, and he hasn't done that yet.
I mean, you read Americans who read the New York Times will read today this interesting sentence. India's economy is dominated by a few elite families who insist on limits to foreign companies and investments to protect their privileged status. Those families largely fund India's political parties through vast unreported cash contributions, making changes to the country's endemic and enervating protectionism difficult to undertake. Will this be taken head on in this meeting?
Which aspect of what you just said?
Protectionism.
Certainly. The issue of trade and open markets and opening market access to the Indian economy is always on the U.S.-India agenda. And that's one of the challenges. I mean, I think you'll see that Indian trade commercial officials constantly have this sort of fear that they'll be, you know, bowing to outside pressure instead of looking at trade opening as something that can further expand their own economy and benefit their own people. I mean, if you look at what's happened since the onset of India's economic reforms in 1991, in the decade between 2001 and 2011, 133 million people were lifted out of poverty. That's happened through this fast growth. The World Bank has done big reports on this. So furthering that growth is going to be beneficial to the Indian economy.
Is this all about hip checking China, or is it really just more about mutual benefits between these two countries?
I'd say a little bit of both. I think both both India and the United States are interested in seeing an Asia that is not dominated by any one power, by China. India as a major democracy, a major economy, a country that is very stable in a region that has a lot of instability surrounding it. Look at what's happening in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Pakistan. India is becoming a net provider of security across the South Asia, Indian Ocean region. So these are all important developments in and of themselves.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about India and the United States as India's leader, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, prepares to address tomorrow a joint session of Congress. Alyssa Ayers is with us from the Council on Foreign Relations. You can join us as well this hour. Are you surprised? It's Obama and Narendra Modi bringing this relationship closer together. Indian Americans, what do you see in these deepening ties? American business people, does India really deliver a welcome mat for you to sell there? Is this really about hip-checking China? Is it more subtle than that? In 2014, after Narendra Modi and his party won the election that elevated him to becoming prime minister, people flooded the streets of his home province of Gujarat chanting, "Modi." He has a complicated background as well. For years, he was not permitted to enter the United States after riots in Gujarat that saw the death of many Muslims there, 1,000 or more. And there's still concern in many quarters about exactly how government's being unfolding there. In February, one student leader, Kanhaiya Kumar, was arrested on charges of sedition for allegedly using anti-India slogans at a student rally. His parents said he was arrested for his opposition to Hindu nationalists. In response to his arrest, thousands protested outside of a New Delhi university, Jawaharlal Nehru University. He was released from jail last week. Here were the earlier protests. So it's not such a simple picture back home either. Alyssa Ayers, please stand by in Washington. With us now as well from Singapore is Nishit Hajjari, Asia editor for Bloomberg View. He's author of The Midnight Furies, The Deadly Legacy of India's Partition. Nishit Hajjari, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
How do you see this Obama-Modi friendship that has grown up over the past couple of years so fast and apparently strong?
It's, I mean, on a personal level, it's an unlikely one. You know, these are two men are very different in their personalities. Modi, as you mentioned, grew up in his career as a Hindu nationalist. Obama has obviously spent a lot of his earlier career focused on the, you know, rights of minority populations and tolerance and so forth. You know, it's really the interests of their nations that have brought them together. Whether they truly, genuinely have a friendship, as Modi in particular likes to portray, is hard to say unless you're in the room with them. But it's more the fact that they both see the advantages to a closer relationship between their countries than anything personal, I believe.
Describe those interests. India's interest in this relationship, the U.S. interest in this relationship now, Nishit.
Well, again, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of this has to do with China in a geostrategic sense. So if you're looking at the defense relationship in particular, which is what seems to be progressing most rapidly right now, India looks around its region, the U.S. looks at its position within Asia and sees a rising China that, in the absence of any pushback, is expanding its ambitions, particularly in the South China Sea, but also on land with its so-called One Belt, One Road program of developing infrastructure across Southeast Asia and Central Asia. And both these countries have an interest in upholding a sort of rules-based international order in which one country doesn't dominate. So if India looks around, it looks for the kind of partner that can best enable them to do that. It's clearly the U.S. But there are also, there's cultural similarities. They're both big democracies. They're multi-ethnic, multi-faith. You have a huge influential Indian-American population in the U.S. that has brought ties closer, big student population. There's a lot of natural reasons why these two countries will gravitate towards each other.
I want to begin to bring our callers into our conversation here. Prakash in Des Moines, Iowa. Prakash, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A couple of quick points. One is Narendra Modi. He's the Prime Minister of India. Calling him Hindu nationalist, I don't believe labeling that is appropriate. The BJP has grown past that, and the Indian citizens and voters look at it totally differently now and gave the party a single majority since 1984.
I mean, he certainly came up out of a Hindu nationalist background. We can talk about where that stands now. Point taken, Prakash. And what else?
And one more point. He ran on the platform of anti-corruption, and he just, on the way to U.S., he stopped at Switzerland. We are yet to get a penny back, black money, back into India. It's been 2 years.
Well, you're talking corruption. So, you're saying the corruption's not cleaned up?
I don't think it even started. Not how much money came, black money came back into U.S., which he promised during the campaign big time that he'll bring billions of dollars will be flowing back into India that were stored outside.
Prakash, let us pick that one up. Alyssa Ayers, you noted that he's done well on corruption front by your lights, but what about black money, by which I guess ill-gotten gains somehow stashed abroad would be the idea?
Right. Well, I think your caller is pointing to something that's been an issue of concern for several Indian governments. The issue is really how people have sequestered abroad ill-gotten gains. So there you get into questions of banking secrecy laws in other countries, particularly Switzerland. I'm sure that was a topic of conversation in the prime minister's stop there. But, the release of the Panama Papers, for example, people who have stored money outside. So finding a way to encourage them to bring that money back is actually an agenda item. I see that is a fundamentally different pursuit from ensuring that there is no further corruption taking place in the government.
Let me bring one more voice into our conversation, if I may. Nisit Hajjari, stand by in Singapore. Alyssa Ayers in Washington. In New York, Siddhartha Deb joins us, contributing editor at The New Republic. He's author of The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India. Recent piece of his in The New Republic headlined, Unmasking Modi, the Violence, Insecurity, and Rage Behind the Man Who Has Replaced Gandhi as the Face of India. Siddhartha Deb, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Our caller, Prakash from Iowa, says it's no longer appropriate to talk about Prime Minister Modi's party as Hindu nationalist. What do you say, Siddhartha?
Well, I mean, the election campaign, the national election campaign, it had two phases, one that was presented to the West, one that was presented in an English-speaking way, and that appealed largely to middle-class Indian, well-to-do Indians, was on the platform of governance and anti-corruption. But those are not just the only people Modi drew support from. In his campaigns in India, he clearly made sectarian threats. He talked about Bangladeshi Muslim populations in India and that they would have to pack up their bags and leave when he came to power. That was 2 years ago when he won the elections. The BJP has just won an election in the northeastern state of Assam, pretty much based on the same premise that, that the local people are getting, as if Muslims aren't local people, but that they're getting demographically swamped. So he's very much a Hindu nationalist. It depends on where. He's not going to be that in Washington. He's not going to be that in Davos. But he's very much a Hindu nationalist in India. And certainly everyone he selected, the people he selected around him, are from the BJP, which is a right-wing party, and which is connected to a violent, sectarian, cultish organization called the RSS.
Nasir Hajjari, what does Modi want out of this visit in terms of placing India in the world? Siddhartha says there's different faces that are shown here. How does it advantage him at home to be seen as having closer ties with the United States, Nasir?
Well, this is the nationalist part of the Hindu nationalist description. Like Shinzo Abe in Japan, like Xi Jinping in China, Modi is first and foremost a nationalist. And so when people look at his economic reform efforts, for instance, and express disappointment about them, a lot of times these are people who expected him to come in and be a sort of Reagan or Thatcher, a liberalizing figure who was pursuing his reforms out of ideological conviction. I think instead, his goal has always been to restore, revive Indian national power and glory. And if a strong economy contributes to that, then that's what you'll pursue. But in addition to that, having a very strong relationship with the most powerful country in the world, and one in which Indians at home can see him, being embraced, almost literally by President Obama, giving this address to the Joint Houses of Congress tomorrow, this all plays into this narrative that India is back. It's on the rise. It is if not a superpower, on its way to becoming one.
Is it on its way to becoming a superpower? What are the obstacles to that, Alyssa?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I was hoping to build on something Nasir just said. I do think India is well along the path to rising on the world stage as a major power. What's interesting is that certainly the BJP has long had as an element of its political platform restoring India to its rightful place on the world stage. And you hear this phrase a lot, the rightful place. Mm-hmm. But you also hear other parties talk about India's rightful place on the world stage. What was interesting about the previous Indian government is that even though they wanted to see India regain that rightful place on the world stage, they were very focused on India's domestic questions, domestic problems, as problems that needed to be overcome before India could aim to be playing a larger global role. I think you see with the Modi government a much more overt bid for power. He's talked about transiting India to becoming a leading power instead of a balancing power. India will continue to work on its many domestic problems while also looking to play that larger role on the global stage at the same time.
What are the biggest of those domestic problems you cite?
Well, there are many. I'm sure the other two guests will also have many to add. But, India still, despite having lifted more than 100 million out of poverty, India still has the largest number of poor in the world living on less than $1.90 per day. It's the World Bank extreme mm-hmm. poverty mm-hmm. threshold. India has not overcome its many social cleavages. Gender is a huge challenge. You've read the news reports about violence against women. This is a huge issue for people. Women's labor force participation has actually dropped in the past decade. That's something that the IMF has been talking about. Caste remains a huge challenge in India. Religious cleavages, discrimination based on region. You have problems of bonded labor continues. You mentioned freedom of expression issues. I mean, there are a lot of complex challenges there, and I don't pretend that India doesn't have problems that it needs to work on and overcome.
Michelle in Atlanta, Georgia. Michelle, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. In regard to, Modi and Obama, I really think this is a home run for Obama and his presidency. I really think he's putting out there some opportunities that we can actually step up to the plate and do something about rather than kind of get caught up in complicated issues. He's speaking to a joint session of Congress tomorrow, and I would encourage Senator Corker and Congressman Ryan to step up to the plate in partnership in regards to that address to Congress. Here in Atlanta, we have kind of an interesting connection. Georgia Tech had one of the two schools across the U.S. that was doing research on solar energy, and we now have a plant producing solar cells called Teneva, which came out of Dr. Ajit Rahaki, the work he did at Georgia Tech. And so I think those issues that Obama's putting in place are in front of Congress, trumps anything else. And I believe that, you know, those are opportunities that we can step up to the plate and do something about them.
I appreciate your call, Michelle. Thank you very much for that. Nasheed Hajjari, do you see Michelle calls it a home run in this closer relationship that President Obama has pushed and more or less accomplished here?
Well, I think it's unquestionably a positive. It's I don't think it maybe resonates quite as much in the U.S. as it does in India, but the groundwork that they've laid over the last 5 or so years, I think will probably persist beyond an Obama administration and beyond a Modi administration. I mean, they've set these two countries on a path towards closer cooperation that will have bumps in the road. I mean, if you remember a few years ago, there was that mini diplomatic scandal over an Indian diplomat in India who's arrested in New York.
Yes.
So those things will come up. There'll be trade disputes. India won't want to have as close a defense relationship as maybe some in the Pentagon will want and so forth. But in the general direction where we're headed, it's going to be good for both countries and will have long-lasting implications for both countries.
Hadi in Boston. Hadi, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. One of your guests has already touched on what I was going to talk about. Violence against women and the caste system, but India remains a very, very deeply racist country. Right now, as we speak, African students are being killed in India. The BBC did a whole program on racism against Africans in India, and, you know, they will not rent apartments to them. They call them monkeys in the streets. If India is going to emerge onto the world stage and become a world power, it has to be more tolerant. I mean, I grew up in Africa, and I had Indian teachers. There's a lot of Indians in Africa. So India has to, don't be fooled by Modi's meeting with the Attorney General, who's black, President Obama, who's half black. You know, he's not showing the underlying racism that exists in Indian culture. That has to change if India is going to become a superpower.
How do you appreciate your call? Siddhartha Deb, how do you respond?
Well, I think he's absolutely spot on in that there's a lot of fluff. There's a lot of rhetoric about, you know, Modi last year did this whole grand thing about meeting with African heads of state. There's a lot of posturing on the world stage. But, you know, as I said, he represents a party that is sectarian, that is sexist, that is casteist, that is chauvinist in all sorts of horrible ways. And I think, you know, the violence that is, you know, Alyssa talked about it, the violence against women is appalling. The violence against the African students in India, the racism against them. But the same thing is true for Indians, too. It is against them, against people who are Muslim, against people who are Christian, against people who are, you know, the Dalits, you know, on the bottom of the caste ladder, tribals. And Modi has had nothing to say about any of this except for an occasional platitude here and there, while all the people he's handpicked seem to encourage this kind of sectarian chauvinistic violence. So I think he's completely right in his criticism.
Is it ironic to you that one of the reasons we're told that the U.S. is in a hurry to get closer to India is that Donald Trump has a more kind of America first view and might not embrace India? But some of the characterizations you're making of Modi there are the kind that are thrown at Mr. Trump here in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, there are significant parallels. I would, you know, you could compare them to other authoritarian figures, playing on nationalism. Putin comes to mind in Russia. Erdogan comes to mind in Turkey, playing on the same combination of insecurity. And the insecurity is something I'm sympathetic to. And we're talking about the insecurity of the people who've done well, but who feel India hasn't still made it in the world. I think I see very much a parallel. And when I wrote the profile of Modi in the New Republic, a number of American commentators said this is who Trump is going to be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the visit of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Washington, meeting today with the President of the United States, and tomorrow addressing a joint session of Congress. Modi and President Obama have had a kind of big relationship that has grown rapidly. Modi, the prime minister, was before he was prime minister, was not given a visa for this country for years because of a previous concern about his previous potential role in riots in Gujarat in India against Muslims there. Now he's leader of the nation. Alyssa Ayers is with us today from the Council on Foreign Relations. Nasid Hajjari from Bloomberg View in Singapore. Siddhartha Deb is with us from the New Republic. What do you see in this evolving U.S.-India tie? Pavan in Austin, Texas is calling. Pavan, you're on the air.
Thanks. So I just have a couple of points. Just now I heard a comment about Donald Trump's campaign going in the same direction as Narendra Modi's. I recently moved to the U.S. I was very much a part of the general elections that happened in India. And I can really attest to that point because this is the most polarized Indian youth I have ever seen on social media. And, I was in college in early 2000s, and we used to have open and, clear discussions about all things political. But of late, it's no longer a discussion, but heavily polarized youth. They just know for a fact that Modi is right without looking into any of the facts. And when I look at how the U.S. presidential campaigns are unveiling, I see a huge parallel in that. So
Pawan, in India, if it's polarized, what are the polls to your light, by your lights in India, Pawan?
It's the right wing Hindu nationalist view versus more liberal view, right? So it's about I'll give you an example. Anytime anybody talks about supporting the Dalits or the lower castes or Muslims or anyone, they are just immediately called out as anti-national. Right, because the whole notion is you are not putting India in front; you are putting a marginalized group in front. And the problem is the baggage that the Indian National Congress, the party which has been in rule for the last 60 years,
yes,
they have been using that to do a heavy vote bank politics, right? So they would always cater to the long tail, and that's how they would always come into power. So the general sentiment is, if you are talking about any sort of liberalism, you are not putting India's interest in front.
Pawan, I appreciate your call. I want to bring it to Alyssa Ayers. Let me get one more call, and I'll do that. I very much appreciate your call, Pavan. Jigar in Houston, Texas. Jigar, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. You put on a great show. I just wanted to make some comments, at least one comment on one of your panelists, Siddhartha Deb. And I just came back from India, and I've spent majority of my adulthood there, and I've been in the United States for 15 years.
Yes.
So I can relate to both the growth of Modi and what's happening in the United States. So I take complete objection to him comparing Modi to the dictators or the authoritarians like Putin, because Modi has been one of the most, I would say, democratic and empowering leaders that I've seen in my adult life. And he has been elected by a complete majority, and that's happened for the first time since the last 35 years in the history of India. And he's not an authority, and people have, I've seen the ground reality, the development he has done in terms of infrastructure development, empowering people in the state where I come from, Gujarat, and that's what he is trying to do in the entire country, and that's why people have elected him. And there are several initiatives, one of them which I believe one of your panelists, Michelle, if I'm wrong.
Alyssa, yes.
Melissa, sorry. She mentioned that the woman empowerment, that's a big issue. It is a big issue. And that's why there have been a significant initiative called Beti Bachao Andolan, which is to save the girl child. And there are several initiatives like this and that he has taken over in the last 2 years.
We've got it. And so you're sort of pushing back on Pawan's view and maybe start Deb's. I'll take it to start the Deb in just a moment. Alyssa Ayers, how do you read this picture of polarization, nationalism, and the different views that are coming to us from Indians or Indian Americans calling in?
Well, India certainly has a polarized political landscape. Right now, we're only talking about two parties, the BJP and the Indian National Congress, mm-hmm. and their supporters are very polarized. But, you know, if you were to go to some other states, like a southern state of Tamil Nadu, you'd be talking about polarization between two other totally different parties that are state-based. So actually in India, excuse me, there's a very diverse political landscape, and it's one of the reasons that it's been so difficult in India for the central government to function. Previous governments, you've heard earlier that the Modi government is the first since 1984 to get a single-party majority mm-hmm. in the lower house of parliament. Previous governments have struggled with how to manage coalitions that had, you know, upwards of 20 different parties in them. Can I just make one point?
Mm-hmm.
India does have a very polarized political environment, but Modi gets very high favorability ratings in public opinion surveys. The most recent survey that came out was carried out by the Pew Research Center. They have fielded another one, and so we'll see the results from that coming out in the fall. But the survey that came out in the fall of 2015 showed an 87% favorable opinion for Modi's leadership. I mean, those are figures that any U.S. politician would, you know, be an envious to receive.
So, Dev, there's no question about that. How do you square those numbers with your observations on Modi? And our caller from Houston who says, look, this is not nationalism being played out here and not authoritarianism.
Well, I love the fact that he couldn't get Alyssa's name right while he was talking about women's empowerment.
Come on,
nobody can ever get my name right. I've suffered with a difficult name.
That's not true.
Let's not stumble on that.
I think he also confuses the fact that, you know, people keep talking about a great majority vote since 1994. It's 30% of the national vote. But even if it was 80%, a majority vote doesn't mean that you can run the country on the basis of majoritarianism. I mean, there is a real confusion about what democracy means. I mean, that's the first thing to be said. And Modi's approval ratings, I mean, I actually, you know, these are high. This is like, you know, conversations from up above mm-hmm. about ratings. And, you know, I travel in India. I mean, you know, talking about corruption scandals, Melissa said there's been no corruption scandals. That is not true. When I was in Bhopal last year, one of the biggest corruption scandals is a Vyapam scam that has happened under a BJP government in MP. So in terms of the polarization, I also think that the polarization that has happened under Modi and under the BJP is different from the kind of various kind of political conflicts, differences in other Indian states. I mean, essentially what Pawan, one of the earlier callers, was saying about being called anti-national, it's not just what called anti-national. There's an incredible spectrum of violence. So there are threats that are on social media, on electronic media, against people who are critiquing India or critiquing Modi. India and Modi have become the same thing. So, you know, there are threats online. There's actual legal intimidation. You mentioned the case of Kanhaiya Kumar. But, you know, Modi's ministers ask the police to do this. There are legal cases, sedition cases filed. And then there is, of course, actual killing by mobs of people in villages, poor people, far away from the mainstream, far away, like Muhammad Akhlaq, killed by a mob for apparently having beef in its refrigerator. I mean, that's the kind of polarization we're talking about. And that's a long way from the kind of difference of political opinion that one might see at any given point of time in India. And by the way, I am not a supporter of the Congress. So, you know, I'm completely the Congress is also not too dissimilar in some ways.
I don't want to lose track of that, but there's more I want to touch as well. Nasit Hajari, looking at this not alliance, but maybe a joint venture between the U.S. and India, a phrase that Alyssa uses with Jonai and others. What about it? When it comes to China, India, as I understand it, has declined to do joint patrols with the United States. So what does this relationship mean? There is a lot of talk now about military equipment sales from the U.S. to India. Is that where the cooperation grows in hard terms?
At first, yes. I mean, you're right. India has declined to do joint patrols, particularly in the South China Sea, which is where the, you know, U.S. is focused right now. And that's understandable. But they have a very high tempo of military exercises. And, you know, you can imagine their cooperation growing, particularly in the Indian Ocean region, which is closer to home for and would make more sense for India. You know, it'll start with defense contracts. It'll start with with co-production. You know, Modi is very keen to use the defense sector as a key part of his Make in India program to spur manufacturing in India. And if you can get, you know, U.S. technology and U.S. Defense projects going within India, you know, that's a way to create jobs. That's a way to spur growth. You know, we're still a long ways from this, and other companies that have try to develop factories in India, you know, even within the last 2 years of Modi's tenure, will say that it's still extremely, extremely difficult. So this is going to be a long-term process.
Nasheed, what about on the nuclear front? India wants to be a supplier of nuclear material around the world, but it's not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. Will the U.S. push for it to join this club of suppliers, even without it joining the NPT?
Yes, I mean, the U.S. already has. It's come out in support of India joining the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which is the organization that governs trade in nuclear-related exports. And, you know, yes, India hasn't signed the NPT, but they have a pretty good record on non-proliferation. They have adhered to, you know, their civilian nuclear plants are under IAEA safeguards, which were negotiated during the U.S.-India nuclear deal in 2008. You know, they've adhered to their commitments there, and, you know, this is would be a sign of their normalization as a nuclear power. It's something that, you know, the U.S. has been pushing for at least since 2008. It's complicated now because China has come out and supported a bid by Pakistan to join as well, and there's obviously a much more complicated case there. I mean, Pakistan has a terrible record on proliferation, and you know, trying to drive an equivalence between the two, you know, frustrates the Indians quite justifiably, I think.
Subhash is calling from Urbana, Illinois. Subhash, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm hearing a lot of impatience about what Modi has not done. And I'm wondering if 2 years is sufficient time for anybody to make any changes that are so significant that everybody is satisfied.
On what front, Subhash?
Front. I mean, people are talking about economics. People are talking about polarization, all kinds of issues. There are significant changes that have taken place. And there is no doubt that corruption is down. It's not going to go away. It has not gone away in the United States. Slavery has gone for 100 years, and still equality is a problem in this country. How impatient are we going to be? And if Modi is really as bad as some of the skeptics are saying, why are international leaders clamoring to get into India?
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Subhas. Alyssa, is there a reason for India's domestic issues, and as you say, there are many, the problems, look, every country has them, to stand in the way of a closer U.S.-India relationship?
No, I don't think so. But I do think that finding a way to talk about these without people getting offended will be important to continue the relationship. And here it's a little bit challenging in the government-to-government relationship because, and this is not at all unique to the Modi government, the Indian government does not like to have another government make comments about its domestic situation. And, of course, the United States does that about every country in the world all the time. That's sort of part and parcel of what we do. So that creates some challenges. I think you saw some of those sentiments coming up in the recent Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, where Americans would like to have a more open public discussion about, you know, what needs to be done on rights issues, what needs to be done on gender issues. I think this should be a full and open discussion. And I also think that Americans should feel comfortable acknowledging our own problems at home as a way of, you know, saying, hey, we're not perfect either. We have a lot of things we need to work on, and let's try to share some of that experience.
Siddharth Deb, how about it? Do you see a reason that the U.S. should go slow, given the concerns that you raise, when, you know, the world's a complicated place?
Yeah, no, I really don't. You know, these are government-to-government issues. I mean, the word that came up most frequently in the first half an hour was defense. And I think, you know, it is clearly a strategic alliance between two. It suits both of them. It's both convenient. I don't think it's very good in terms of democracy, in terms of diversity. I mean, India has a wide range of opinions. It's not, you know, and India has a large number of people who actually are very, very concerned and active on issues of caste and gender, race. And, you know, and they talk to, and there are people in America who are like that too. So, you know, I'm not talking about the people, but this is a very much an alliance, a marriage of convenience. It helps Modi's image in India to be seen, to be courted by the West. And it's not just America. France and Britain have also been very much on similar grounds. I think it's disappointing, ultimately, for me as a writer, as an independent citizen of India. I think it's very disappointing for me to see the United States willing to ignore this, all the human rights violations, just because the strategic alliance is so vital to it now.
Nasir Hajjari, last word goes to you in Singapore. Barack Obama's time is now short in office. Does this closer relationship sustain beyond his years in the White House?
I think it will. I think because the interests between the two countries are so obvious that any administration would be hard-pressed to argue why they should reverse course at this point. As long as, you know, as India's democracy remains strong, as long as, you know, these issues don't get out of control, as Siddhartha was warning, you know, I think both countries will find reasons to move forward.
Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, speaks to a joint session of Congress tomorrow, and I hope you go into that listening to that with a little more clued in sense of all that lies behind. Nasir Hajjari with Bloomberg View in Singapore, our great thanks to you. Siddhartha Deb with the New Republic in New York. Alyssa Ayers at the Council on Foreign Relations, our thanks to you all. Listeners, thanks for your calls as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.